Hello, and welcome to the first episode of our second season here on the Ether Podcast. I'm your host, Laura Thurston Goodrow, and I'm pleased to be visiting today with U.S. Army Major Benjamin Statz, the author of Space Weaponization, Reexamining the Historical Air Analogy to Space, in our special edition of Ether dedicated to space scholarship and professional military education, which we released last month in December 2023. Ben currently serves as the aide-de-camp to the Deputy Commander of U.S. Space Command. He is an Army Space Operations Officer and a graduate of the Schriever Space Scholars Program. Ben holds a master's degree in international science and technology policy from George Washington University, where he focused on space policy and security. Prior to his current assignment, Ben served as a future operations planner at U.S. Space Command and has also served in the Army 1st Space Brigade and at U.S. Army Space and Missile Defense Command. Welcome to the podcast, Ben.
Hi, thank you. No, it's thanks for having me. I'm really happy to talk through the article and any questions you have about it. I'm just ready to kick it off when you are.
Okay, that sounds great. So first, other than the obvious, your military career, tell us a little bit about the background of your interest in the subject of, you know, this analogy that air power scholars, space power scholars use between air and space power development.
As a product of Air University and Air Command and Staff College, that's really where some of these initial ideas began. And so a lot of my research, when I showed up, you know, had to do a thesis and develop a paper. And I was really interested in high altitude balloons. I've obviously published other things on that as well. But as part of that research, I did a historical research on that and the evolution of balloons from high altitude and lower altitudes and how they've been employed historically, just to kind of gain a better understanding. And I was doing that in parallel with the Air Command and Staff and Schriever Space Scholar curriculums, which were looking at air power and space power. And so I kind of looked and thought, you know, I think there was a gap to me in some of the research on air power dynamics and evolution before the Wright brothers. And that's where, you know, I learned about, okay, well, Billy Mitchell's definition for the ability to do something in air, it's just a simple way to look at how we define air power. Well, Billy Mitchell did a lot of research in talking about balloons before planes really came of age. And so that's where I kind of started making these connections at Air Command and Staff College. And then I had a really great experience at George Washington University where I was able to take some of those ideas. I had a great professor, Professor Pete Hayes, who really helped me kind of pull the thread on that research and dive into it. And he asked me great questions that really helped me kind of then pull the requisite insights for my research.
That's fantastic. It's wonderful to have those, you know, educators and scholars in our background that really inspire us to push our thought to the next level and explore those unexplored questions. So that's great to hear. So first, to kind of set the scene for this, tell us about conventional wisdom, I guess we would call it that, regarding the beginnings of air power and then the alternative view that you propose in your article.
As I kind of mentioned, with my experience at Air Command and Staff College, air power, you know, studies, and it's no criticism to Air University whatsoever, but I think it creates a blind spot where you think about, we're studying air power and we're thinking about air power from the perspective of beginning with the Wright brothers and the age of the plane. But what I kind of saw or observed was that gap. And well, what about balloon evolution? Because the ability to do something in the air started with those balloons and putting humans in those balloons to achieve tangible effects. And so what I looked at was, you know, there was military reconnaissance, you know, urban planning, there was cartography for map building, and there was, you know, commercial aspects to it with like taking people up and down for trips. And so I really looked at that air power analogy starting back with the Montgolfier brothers. And I think that that's a blind spot because the senior leaders today and, you know, in the past, and that's where LeMay's quote I have in the paper is so interesting because I think it's very reflective of the historical lens that we kind of put on air power today. He was thinking about air power starting with, you know, the plane and the Wright brothers. And I think senior leaders today and as products of the Air University, I think that's kind of how they think from a historical perspective. Mm-hmm. But I think that's kind of like the gap or the issue is that we look at air power kind of falling out, the development of air domain and air power kind of falling out of favor as a useful analogy to space domain and space power today. But I think that that's looking at it from a strategic operational type analogy or perspective. You know, when you think about space traffic management, when you think about, you know, operating in space in a warfighting domain, operationally, that there's a more useful insights we can gain from the analogy to the maritime and the high seas and the sea with, you know, protecting commerce. And so I think that's really taken on favor. But if you think about it from a historical perspective and how the domain has evolved over time, I really do think it starts with, you know, humans being in balloons, because that's where you could start to do something in the air, just like we've been doing for space. And so I think just looking at it through a different lens has been very insightful to me. And then, you know, furthering that research that I did, I think really pulled some additional insights from that.
I learned a lot reading the pieces about the French aeronauts.
Aerosteers. You know,
it was really an interesting short history there. So then we go to, now that you've corrected kind of this perspective, this analogy, and now we go into what the similarities are then between the start of air power, starting with balloons back all the way up, you know, to today, and then the start of space power in the 60s to today. And then as part of that, what occurred in air power in that historic telling, the rapid increase and expansion of weaponization of the air that occurred, you know, in the 20s, and comparing that to what's happening today in space.
Yeah. And I think what's instructive from the analogy that I did was you do see this kind of slow progression early on, right? We're trying to doing experimentation, we're testing capabilities. Some of those are weapons. And you see that intermittent development throughout air power history, starting with balloons. And there's no perfect analogy with it, right? We're just trying to pull what's instructive from that. And I think you see the parallel theme of that kind of a, you know, intermittent evolution of, you know, whether it's, you know, weapon testing in space with the terrestrial ASAT testing and stuff that's been littered throughout history. And I think that the themes that I identified through that, you know, technological lens and the geopolitical lens and the legal framework, like that nexus of events, I think is parallel. What we're seeing today is parallel to what we saw at a certain peak in the evolution of air power with the planes, with the plane evolution and so forth. But that really started with, you know, Zeppelins, you know, which were still balloons, just giant airships. And they were, you know, designed to be used for, you know, bombing raids. And, you know, that was before planes even were developed. As I did my research, that was the theme that came out, that, you know, you had this slow progression and then you had this kind of dynamic of technology, geopolitics, and the legal framework that was in place. And I think that's very reflective of what we're seeing today with the geopolitical conditions, with the way technology is advancing and diffusing tied to space capabilities. And then the legal framework that, you know, kind of exists, I think, is similar to the one that exists in the air domain of the early 20th century. With those analogies, I do kind of want to point out, I was very cautious about developing these analogies. You know, I didn't want to say, oh, one or two things are identical, therefore, like, here's all these implications that I'm suggesting. I think as you see throughout the paper, I identified several parallel themes throughout the evolution of both domains. And it really kind of culminated in that nexus of those three conditions. And so totally right, you know, cognizant of the fallacy that, you know, analogies can lead people to. But I think that what I was able to highlight was really combining one big analogy piece and then trying to show my insights. It was almost like two papers in one that I tried to like condense. But because that air power analogy doesn't have any kind of research prior to mine, and it doesn't have any kind of acceptance currently across the base communities, I felt like I had to spend time kind of establishing that analogy and the legitimacy of it to kind of demonstrate the utility of the insights that I pulled from it.
Well, so the themes you talk about, reconnaissance and operational constraints and institutional structures, kind of pulling on those as as analogous to the air power. And then the mention of your three concerns, that this addresses those concerns with that analogy. So I thought that was really helpful too. Now, what are some of the components? Later in the piece, you talk about keys to rapid and intense weaponization. You talk about components and implications of our contemporary rapid and intense weaponization of space. Can you talk about that a little bit?
So as I, looked at, the different dimensions or themes with the technology and geopolitical and legal, I kind of came to the conclusion that it's really going to come down to the geopolitical dimensions. That's really going to be the driving factor. Because when I looked at how it evolved early 20th century with air power, you saw this, the Triple Entente and the geopolitical conditions and the security interests and the, alliance agreements and so forth. And so when I looked at technology, to me, is, as a technology policy guy from school, based on our principles and our values, we want to encourage innovation and we want to continue to develop technology. It's just kind of counter our principles to kind of stifle technology in any way. It's not rational to me based on efforts to restrain or constrict certain technology. I mean, technology is going to continue to evolve. And even if a particular state constrains technological development, another state will continue that effort. And so to me, it's self-defeating to constrain technology. So technology to me, and an ideal world, and I think really the world we live in now, we foster that technological development and innovation. And so to me, technology is going to continue to grow and evolve and diffuse. And so I don't think that there's any way to constrain that to prevent conflict in space potentially. So technology, and obviously one of the results of that's weapons, I think is that will continue to grow and expand and advance. From the legal perspective, I looked at, okay, well, there was a legal framework, and you could see how with the Hague Convention, as the security dynamics changed, I don't want to completely constrain myself with this legal framework. And we see that today, of course. And at the end of the day, if a conflict breaks out, we saw the air power, but the legal regime just collapses. There was no legal regime. When you look at laws of armed conflict, an important consideration. But I mean, I think there's throughout history been concerns about, well, once we're in a major conflict, a lot of times those laws of armed conflict compliance, to those can go out the window. And obviously they should guide conflict, but as conflict continues to escalate and expand, especially in major wars, kind of to see that legal framework collapsing in the future and that, the current space legal framework, it's been very hard to make changes to it. And even if it was attainable to gain a stronger legal framework, the US, we, had a moratorium on ASAT weapons. And I will say that there's particular actors you would hope would have agreed to that and supported that, but we haven't seen that. And so to me, that's just an indicator that, we shouldn't expect the legal framework to uphold when it comes down ultimately to the last consideration I had, the geopolitical conditions and the geopolitical environment. And so at the end of the day, I really think it comes down to, how we navigate those geopolitical conditions and decisions. I think that kind of answers where I was getting at with where my research led me.
Yeah. Especially with the space treaty not being updated since 1967. And I think there's a huge potential for conflict to really go wild in space if we have major world conflict.
So. Right. And I am of the position, where I've looked at through my research, I don't believe weapons make war or offensive strategies make war. I'm more of the camp that suggests that you're going to have these weapons and technologies and they're going to continue to advance and evolve. And it's really a geopolitical decision, how we manage those tensions and security and how we ensure we have off ramps. And that's the real challenge. And to be frank, I think that to this date, right, there hasn't been major conflict in space. And so I think that that's been managed quite successfully throughout our recent history, because as I kind of mentioned in the paper, I really think starting in the 21st century, we started to see these indicators of the rapid and intense weaponization of space, with all those cross-domain weapons and yep. some on-orbit capabilities that certainly have the potential to conduct nefarious activities in space, certainly.
Yeah, RPOs and hand and all the other things. So with all this in mind, do you want to talk about more specifically about some of those specific technological developments that we have that we're using that are not going to be constrained in their development that we have to, use wisely and carefully?
Yeah. So certainly, you know, I'm of the position that we kind of moved the goalpost on what we consider space weapons. You know, I looked at early research, you know, especially with SDI, really kind of started, you know, a lot of concerns with weaponizing space. And the writings that I did all my research through looking at throughout the 80s and stuff, even earlier with the 70s and so forth, a lot of research kind of said, hey, like if you can achieve the effect in space, you know, that's weaponizing space. We don't say cruise missile that's launched from a ship out on the coast and it, you know, hits a land target. We don't say that, oh, hey, the sea is weaponizing the land or vice versa with missiles that go in towards targets. So it's a cross domain. And that's what I was really getting at with ASAT, you know, the perspectives from the 80s with the SDI and other concerns with FOBs, fractional orbital bombardment system development. Like those were seen as just as dangerous as a weapon being placed in space. And throughout the 21st century, we've seen proliferation of actors developing terrestrial-based ASAT weapons. And to me, that is weaponizing the space domain because those effects that those weapons can achieve in space are just as capable or potent as, you know, if you had them on orbit per se. So I really do think that that's an interesting dynamic because today, you know, with the Peros and PPWT, you know, the argument is, oh, hey, it's just focused on orbit space systems, but it has no considerations for all the terrestrial based systems, which, you know, is concerning. And that to me kind of makes it seem like the goalpost has changed where before we recognized in early literature, hey, those are weapons. Those are dangerous space weapons. And now today it's like, well, those are okay, but the on orbit ones are the ones we're concerned about. So I kind of feel like that goalpost has moved a bit.
Yeah. Others have recently made that same observation. So I think you're spot on. So do you have any recommendations for planners, strategists, and policymakers?
So I certainly do think that based on my research, it seems that given those three conditions, geopolitics and legal and technology, it seems that it's instructive from the air power analogy that there's going to be weaponization in the space domain. And so I think that's a very, very, very likely inevitability based on my research. But that doesn't mean that conflict in space is inevitable. And that ties back to my argument about geopolitics. I think the nuclear weapons are very instructive from this perspective. And, you know, you've got all the literature on the dynamics of, you know, nuclear weapon employment and strategy, you know, starting with, you know, Bernard Brody and so forth, and where they looked at the dynamics of that. And there hasn't been a nuclear war, not to equate space and nuclear war, but they're certainly both concerns from a geopolitical perspective and security dynamic. But I do think that, like, we'll have to take deliberate actions to continue to navigate the security tensions in this geopolitical environment to mitigate, you know, conflict from breaking out in space. But I do think that weapons will continue to advance and evolve, and some of those on-orbit capabilities like the on-orbit satellite servicing, the ARM, RPO activities, all those types of things will continue to advance and develop and ultimately demonstrate or illustrate that, you know, space indeed, if not already, is weaponized. But again, I'll emphasize this, conflict in space is not inevitable. And so that's where, you know, I've come across a lot of very competent, capable, talented professionals across Office of Secretary of Defense, Department of State, the efforts they do with the UN. I've come across professionals just across the United States government who are dedicated, committed to preventing conflict from breaking out in space. But my advice would be we have to be prepared, obviously, to deter conflict in space. But then if conflict should break out in space, how do we appropriately, you know, still ensure the U.S. and our allies and partners prevail in that type of conflict? If it starts to escalate there, how do we offer it? And this, it all comes back to that geopolitical dynamics. That, you know, I don't want to seem like that's the easy button. Like, oh, we just make deliberate decisions and mitigate. It's incredibly difficult and challenging and hard, and something that, you know, professionals in the United States government and other governments and our allies and partners have to, you know, drive through every day that they're at work. And so, and based on this perspective, I do think that, you know, one of the counterarguments I addressed is, you know, as I talk about what I think is going to happen in the space domain, you know, it's looked at, you know, I'm just, you know, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. I'm saying it, and, you know, it's, I'm kind of advocating for it to go in that direction. But as I kind of mentioned, you know, despite decades of the U.S. national policy, you know, highlighting the vital national interest that space is for the U.S. and its allies and partners and our economic and security interests, you know, others still have deliberately developed capabilities to, you know, threaten that vital national interest. And so to me, it's not necessarily a security dilemma. And this is probably a whole nother argument. But to me, it's not really a security dilemma. I think the dilemma is actually the geopolitical dilemma of we've reached this precipice of tensions and I have to make a determination between potentially doing something, acting first, or you taking the risk of an adversary potentially acting first. Like that to me is a dilemma. Two really unacceptable points. I think that, okay, like developing an offensive strategy, I don't think is a security dilemma. I think it's a choice that we make, but it's not a dilemma. I'm trying to ensure that, you know, my security and economic interests continue to be protected. I would just kind of think about that as a strategy, as a strategist, planner, policymaker, looking at it through that dynamic.
Well, it's a tall order.
Certainly.
And a lot of good people, as you said, are devoted to seeing it to a good end. So as we close, is there anything else you'd like to add?
Yeah, the only other thing I'd like to add to kind of caveat that last two questions, I think is, you know, I showed a lot of the similarities between air power and space power. And of course, I have a lot of research on the differences. And I think one of the key differences that I pointed out too is that when it came to air power, there wasn't a lot of risk with, you know, conducting conflict in the air domain. And I think that's significantly different with the space domain. There are lots of risks tied to conflict in space. And that's why I am actually optimistic that we can prevent conflict in space, because there are significant risk trade-offs with, you know, debris and, you know, access and stifling commercial opportunities in space. And so I think that, you know, international prestige or perspectives, how you're viewed upon. So I think that that is what's really interesting and unique about the space domain. And I think that favors our ability to mitigate and prevent conflict from occurring in space. So at the end of the day, I am optimistic from that perspective.
Well, that's good news, especially from where you sit. So, well, this has been great. I really appreciate you joining me on the podcast and talking about your article. I commend your article, Space Weaponization, Reexamining the Historical Air Analogy to Space, in our special edition of Ether that we sent out last month in December 2023. Ben's article is in there along with other ones that are very interesting. So thanks again.
Yes, of course. Thank you again for having me.